Good evening. My name is Meredith Murniak, and although Dennis was billed as giving the talk tonight, I'm his wife, and I also have studied and worked in fish farming for about the past 10 years. And so before he gets into the specifics of fish farming in Africa, I'm going to just give you a little general introduction to aquaculture as a whole. Aquaculture is defined as raising plants or animals under controlled conditions in water. And this can be compared to agriculture, where you're raising crops on land. Fish farming that we've been working in is one type of aquaculture. There are other crops that you can grow in water, such as oysters or shrimp, or plants such as algae or seaweed or wild rice. So fish farming is just one kind of thing that can be considered a type of aquaculture. And for our purposes, we're going to narrow down the definition a little bit closer to say that we're going to be discussing just the type of fish farming where you're using the fish as a source of food. Maybe some of you are familiar with other types of fish farming that are more familiar to us as Americans, such as raising fish for bait, sometimes minnows are cultured, or raising ornamental fish that are sold for aquariums, and also something that most of us know about, where fish are raised in hatcheries and then are stocked in public waters to enhance sport fishing opportunities. Raising fish as a source of food is a relatively new concept in the United States. However, it has a long history in other areas of the world. The people in China have been raising fish, primarily several species of carp, for about 4,000 years. And still today in China, fish, cultured fish, are a very important part of the diet in many areas. I talked to someone who came back from China, and they said they had a big carp 3 times a day. When he was over there. That was the main food. In Europe, fish farming has been going on for several hundred years. And one of the interesting things that I learned when I was at Holden several years ago, Joseph Sittler is a theologian. He came up to me when he knew I was working with a fish farming project, and he said, "Did you know Martin Luther was a fish farmer?" And I was surprised to hear that. But he said, it's recorded in his table talks that he refers to his vocation or his holy calling as 1, to be a preacher of the word, 2, a teacher, 3, father of a family, and 4, warden of the carp ponds. So I guess that's a pretty good precedent for us to get involved in fish farming. The development of fish farming in the United States began in the early 1950s. And in the last decade, it has really developed onto a large scale through a lot of research and extension activities. And now there are big commercial fish farming operations, primarily in the Pacific Northwest here with trout and salmon, and also in the southeastern United States with channel catfish. We've been doing a little bit of work in Minnesota, but we haven't really developed to the point where we can say we have a commercial industry there yet, but we're trying to get it started. Fish farming has also recently been introduced in a lot of developing countries as a possible new source of protein. And it has proven highly successful. There are several reasons why Dennis and I think, and I guess it's just pretty much straightforward reasons that most people believe why fish farming could become a very important source of protein in a lot of developing countries and could be used to combat the problems with hunger and malnutrition that are so widespread there. One reason is because it's a very high-protein crop. You don't have to combine it with, if you have rice, say you have to have beans to get a complete protein, whereas fish is a complete protein, and it's well-accepted food in many areas. Second reason is because you can obtain very high yields. With fish, yields of, say, 1 ton or 2 tons of fish per acre per year would be a common yield, and that would be much higher than crops you could raise in land, or usually areas you use for aquaculture probably wouldn't be very suitable for land crops anyway. So in probably an area that couldn't be used for any other crop, you can get high yields of fish. Another reason is that fish are very efficient animals at converting supplemental feed to protein, to fish flesh, compared to land animals. With a cow or something along those lines, you have to, say, add 6 to 8 pounds of supplemental feed to get a pound of, of weight gain, whereas with fish, you can just add 1 to 2 pounds of feed and you'll get a pound of gain. And so this makes them inexpensive both economically and also ecologically. You can get high yields of fish at low cost. And the last reason is because it's a fairly simple technology. Once people have learned how to build ponds and stock fish, they can carry on the project without a lot of assistance from the outside. And we think this is a really important thing to look at when you're looking at development work. When the people that are setting up the project have to leave for some reason, the local people can carry on and also teach their neighbors how to do it. So I guess I'll just turn it over to Dennis now. He spent 4 years in Zaire with the Peace Corps. 2 years of he was there, he was working on a fish farming project. And we've recently heard and read from several places that the fish farming project that he and quite a few other volunteers worked with has kind of become one of the success stories of Peace Corps in Africa. So I'll turn it over to him.
Wait one. Yeah. Let me get my gadgets for. Thank you, Meredith, for your introduction to fish farming. Now that we all know what fish farming is. As Meredith said, the country that I was in was Zaire, and probably you all know that by another name, which is his former name, the Belgian Congo. It gained its independence in 1961, and that's when the name was changed to Zaire. This is the orange country right here. This is equivalent to the size of the part of the United States east of the Mississippi River. It's a pretty large country. It's a very diverse country in its landforms and vegetation. You get tropical rainforests up into the high altitude mountains where you're in alpine meadows. The people are just as diverse. There's over 200 languages spoken within the country. There's French is the official language, but the only people that speak French are those who have gone to school and are educated. And there's 4 major trade languages within the country that are used by missionaries and most expatriates because it's impossible to learn all the local languages. You may need to work in an area from here to Chelan. You may need to know 5 different local dialects. That's almost impossible for one person. So that's only there for a short time. So this is why a trade language is useful, because Zaire is basically divided into 4 areas. If you draw a line down the middle and vertically and horizontally, there the 4 languages that are spoken are Kikongo, Chiluba, Swahili, and Lingala. When I was there, I spoke Kikongo on the fish farming project. Zaire is basically a very poor country, and thusly it's classified as a developing country. People are subsistence farmers, mainly. There are 4 or 5 major cities which would resemble the United States as far as industry and restaurants and cinemas and housing. But once you get out of those large cities, you're in the bush and you're in a rural area. Even though the people are poor by our standards, they certainly seem to be very happy. They're not happy with their situation, but they are pleasant people, very hospitable, opened. They will share just about anything they have with you. I remember one time being invited to eat dinner with some people that I was helping build a fish pond, and there was 1 hard-boiled egg that was divided between 4 people. And when somebody will do that, that tells you they'll share about anything they have. This is a typical house that you might find in the villages. It's made from materials that are just gathered in the forest or on the grasslands. And there's no hardware store, so you don't go to the hardware store to buy nails or any materials you need. You go out in the woods and get what you need. And the house is made of sticks that they cut down from the forest, tied together with vines, and they pack mud in the walls, and that mud dries and forms a hard wall, and the roof will be covered with grass. And it's a very adequate house. This is the one that I lived in, and it kept the rain out, and it was cool, and I had no complaints with it. The people have to be resourceful because they don't have all the stores and imported goods that they can get, so they make do with what they have. And you find this at a very early age, even the children. In this slide, for example, you can see that these are mushrooms that the children were out gathering in the forest, and this is part of their food. They were sent out to go get some food. That's what they did. This child here made a hat out of banana leaves. They're just kind of handy. Here's another slide of a boy that was out working in the fields, and it was a little sunny, so he made himself an umbrella out of, again, banana leaves. And you might think he has four arms, but what that is there is his younger sister's legs. He's carrying her on his back, back to home. And he's responsible for watching his sister all day long, as his mother might be out working somewhere else. Children just take that responsibility. They'll watch five or six other children at a very early age. Here again is a slide of a young boy who made a crane. He probably saw a construction company that was there that had some machinery, and he copied it and made it out of raffia palm. And you can see here's the crane going out and the little hook and the cab where the driver would be in. And then he has the steering wheel going up here and he's steering it. Now this is all made by himself, and that's not his craft or anything. That's just something they do. There's no toy store, so they have to do that. Some of the imports of Zaire are coffee, tea, rubber, and palm oil, which is made from a nut that comes from the palm tree. Also, the country is very rich in minerals. They have copper, diamonds, and uranium. Exports. Thank you, John. These are coffee beans that they picked. When they come off the coffee tree, they're this color here, the red or greenish. They put them out in the sun, and they dry, and they turn brown like these over here. Up in the corner, you see some that have been out there longer. They're just about ready to be sacked up and sent out. Once you get out of the large cities, you get onto dirt roads that are pretty hard to get by with or to get through. Transportation and communication in interior country are very difficult or non-existent. This is a major highway leaving Kinshasa, which is the capital, going east. And this is one of the better roads. It's just sandy soil here, so you can imagine after rain, it might look something like this one here, washed out. And in this area, they didn't have machinery to come in, like a road grader or a bulldozer or anything like that, so it's all done by hand. Whatever village is located near that section of road is responsible for repair. And so one Saturday, they just say, okay, it's road day. Everybody get your shovel and come on out at 7 o'clock, and they'll have 100 people out there shoveling in, filling in those holes. And that'll last until next heavy rain, and then it'll get washed away again, and then eventually they'll move the road. If it's a low, wet area, it's going to be muddy, and trucks can get stuck up to the axles, and it's hard to get out. So you travel within the country according to the seasons, whether it's a rainy season or dry season, and whether you have to go over bridges, the bridge could be out. Here's a shot of this isn't upside down, by the way. Here's a small bridge going over a river. Truck came down it, and the bridge broke. The truck tipped over, and these are the sacks of produce that it was carrying. The truck sat there for 2 months before they could get parts, or not parts, to get a machine to come and pull the thing out. And this is some of the problems within moving things around, transportation. It's just very difficult. And it all adds to the problem of nutrition, because if an area does not have good soils, or if area has a drought or a famine or blight, they can't. It's difficult to move in supplies. The rivers are one of the most reliable means of transport, and through Zaire goes the Congo River, and there's a lot of tributaries that go into that, and people use that by canoes like this, which is a dugout canoe. And also riverboats that will go up maybe once or twice a week. Again, the riverboat is susceptible to breakdown, and then you have the problems of getting parts for it, or gasoline or diesel, whatever it runs on, sometimes is in short supply, so occasionally they are out of action too. The last means of transport, besides walking, is missionary airplanes. Now that's fairly reliable. They get their parts from outside the country, and they seem to be able to get a good supply of fuel, and they will fly from mission to mission, bringing in supplies to the hospitals and schools or people that are sick, taking them to the hospital or back, and they certainly provide for a desperate need that's within the country. In the area that I was in, which is western Zaire, the people were traditionally hunters. And in the past, when the populations were low and the game was abundant, life was pretty good because they could get a source of protein from the animals that they hunted. Now, this picture is taken in East Africa, and these are wildebeest. This is just to give you some idea of what the game looked like at one time. It's just very abundant. Now you can only find this on game parks or reserves, because everywhere else they're just about wiped out due to the population increase and the overhunting, and also due to the habitat destruction of the animals. So the people now are forced to utilize other types of foods. And they still hunt, but they have to go after smaller animals. And these two guys were out hunting, and they shot a couple of bats. These are fruit bats, and they will eat them. Also in the diets of the people are rats, caterpillars, grasshoppers, a lot of insects, grub worms that are found on the palm trees. These are all sources of protein, and the people are forced to eat these kind of foods because they don't have anything else. Well, they like them, but I'm sure if they had an antelope or an impala running by, they would take that over a bat or a rat. I mean, it's been probably so long since anybody there can remember the game being that abundant that they've probably just had a gradual transition, and this is now part of their regular diet. This is a typical cultivated field. It's not like we might find in Minnesota, where you have rows and rows, straight rows of corn and soybean. Here everything's just, it's called a slash burn agriculture. They go, they cut the forest down, they burn it, they plant their crops. It's not really planted in rows or in orderly fashion. And they will leave, these are the palm trees. They do leave the palm trees because they get a lot of products from this. They get the palm nut, as I mentioned. They get the raffia that you can make certain things out of. The branches are used in the building of houses. They also tap the top of the branches, or the top of the trunk, let's say on this tree right about there, and they get a liquid that comes out which turns into wine within about 2 hours. It ferments, and it's called palm wine. It's like a cross between beer and wine, and is a favorite drink of the people there. The low bushes here are manioc or cassava plant, and this is a staple throughout most of Africa and also in South America. And the manioc plant has a tuber, which is like an elongated potato, and they take that and they dry it and they pound it up into a flour and they cook it in boiling water and stir it, and it comes out somewhat like the consistency of bread dough before it's cooked. And they'll eat this with every meal. It's the main food that they have. And if they have a little bit of meat with it, they'll eat a lot of manioc and a little bit of meat. Or if they have vegetables, they'll surely have manioc and some vegetables with it. Problem with this is that this food is very low in nutritious value. It's mostly carbohydrate or starch. So, for example, if a child is hungry and he's crying, "I'm hungry," give him some manioc, he'll eat it, he'll feel like he's eaten, he'll stop crying, but yet he got very little as far as his diet goes. The Africans tend to have large families. Men can have more than one wife, and this adds to the problem. Big families and not a lot of food to go around, and so it's usually the children that are affected by this. Infant mortality rate within the country is very high. It's common to talk to somebody and say, "How many children do you have?" "Well, I have 10 children, 5 of them died." It's 40-50%, it seems like. I'm sure the average is not that high, but in the area where I was, where malnutrition and other protein deficient diseases was widespread, it was extremely high. And this was the reason why I was sent there with Peace Corps. It was myself and 7 other volunteers were sent in the Bandundu region to start up a fish farming project, check out whether it would be feasible in the area, would the climate be suitable for raising fish, would the people be willing to do this type of work, would they want to eat the type of fish that we would raise. So I went there and went to the village where I was going to be working, introduced myself to the chiefs of the different villages, met the people, told them what I was there for, and those who expressed an interest in fish farming, I'd visit them and consult them on building fish ponds and raising fish. First thing they'd have to do, if they had a site that was suitable, was to clear it. And this is what an area would look like before it was cleared. In the background, you can see the jungle. And they would clear this by hand. They would take machetes and axes and cut them down and then dig around the stumps and pull up the stumps. They had no chainsaws. They didn't have the dozers to knock them over. At first, I was a little concerned or a little hesitant to look at a forested area and say, "This is a good site for a fish pond. Clear it." I just couldn't see how they could do it. But I finally learned that it was no big deal then. That's the only way they knew to do it. They didn't know about the machinery, so it might take 6 months, but they'd get it done. Once they cleared the site, then they'd build their ponds. And what we have here are 2 ponds that are completed in the top and 2 that are under construction here. What would be required would be to find a clay soil. We want clay because it can hold water and it's strong, as opposed to mud or sandy soil, which water will percolate through. Get that clay soil, and then, for example, here they had to dig into the side to reach the clay, and they would build up these walls here. And sometimes, if they're building up this wall here, they'd be carrying it in baskets on top of their heads or pails. And you can see here's a wheelbarrow. You can't make it out very well, though. And level the bottom off. This wall, I think, is about 5 feet high. So you can imagine the amount of work to carry that dirt by wheelbarrow or by on top of your head in a basket and dump it and just keep going until the wall is built. And what they do is usually have a lot of the relatives and friends come and help, and you might find 25 people at one time working on a fish pond. It's just an incredible amount of work. Remember, you're in the tropics, the sun is hot, people are loaded with parasites, they're not eating a good diet, and yet they do this incredible amount of work. We want a smooth bottom. I'm not sure if I understood your question. You're asking why? Yeah, you would if it's a you know, some type of soil that the water will go through. You'd have to line it with clay, but in this case, it was clay at the. There was just like a layer of topsoil, and once you dug that out, you got in the clay, and so and then just to build the wall up, you could carry the clay in from the side. It all depends on the site. Some places you don't need to go into dig a hole to get down to it. Sometimes all the soil is clay. This is another pond that's completed. We encourage them planting grasses on the side to prevent erosion. This pond is drained out. And this is, here is a feeding ring where they would feed the fish. The type of fish that we work with was called the tilapia, which is also known as St. Peter's fish. The reason we work with this fish was because it grew very fast. It ate many different types of foods. It was pretty much disease resistant, and it reproduced fast. It's similar to a bluegill or a crappie that we'd have in the United States. It would not grow up in this climate. It needs a warm water. It would die out in the winter. The types of foods that would, well, once the people put the, finished their ponds and stocked them, then they'd feed the fish, because if you just put fish in there and don't feed them, they're not going to grow real fast. It's kind of comparable to raising chickens. If you have a chicken in a coop and you don't give him any food, he's not going to do very well. But if you, same thing with the fish, if you feed him a lot, then he's going to grow fast. And so we had the people feeding them every day, and never to feed them anything that could be consumed by humans. They would feed them other types of food, waste products, or, for example, table waste, peels of pineapples, bananas, leaves that they found in the forest. The fish would eat them. In 5 minutes, they could throw in a handful of leaves, and the only thing that would be left would be stems. They would feed them termites. The main food of the fish was the plankton. They would put compost in the ponds, which would fertilize that water and encourage plankton bloom, which would, the water would almost turn green. And this is the type of, the fish could filter out those small microscopic animals and plants and eat that. So within 6 months after stocking the fish, they were about ready to harvest, and harvest procedure would be to drain the pond out completely. And this could be done either by a drainage structure. If they didn't have a drainage structure, they would just break a hole in the dam. That's what you see right here. And they're putting a net in front of that hole. All the water drain out, and then they'll get the fish. Now, the people hanging around on the sides here are people that are waiting to buy fish, because when they had a harvest, they would keep what they wanted for themselves, and the rest they would sell. And usually the day of a harvest was mass chaos, because everybody wanted to buy fish, and it was just fighting and pushing and shoving, trying to get up there to get it. That's how much of a demand there was for fish, fresh fish. These round holes, incidentally, are nests that the fish make to lay its eggs. During the 6 months, the original fish you put in probably reproduced two or three times, and their offspring might reproduce, and so you have an assortment of sizes. You have the original fish that are perhaps up to a half a pound, down to little, very small fry. And it didn't matter, people would eat any size. Here they're going through the pond with the seine net to get out the fish. Sometimes, but that's true, but okay, yeah, let me address that question. People that had fish ponds would take what they wanted, and they would consume that in 1 or 2 days, and the rest they would sell. The reason they sold it is because they wanted other things. They needed sugar, They wanted sugar. I shouldn't say they needed it. They might have wanted a piece of cloth for their wife because it's a tradition that, or a custom that a man give his wife one or two pieces of clothing a year. Pretty close. Well, it depends. You can make a little diversion canal and go as far as the water would, you know, take to get the water go there. You just want water as near as possible to be able to fill the pond when needed, or in case of emergency, if it's a real something, the weather conditions are cloudy or something, and algae is dying out. It's not getting sunlight. It's not producing oxygen. You get oxygen drops in the pond, and then you need to put in new water because the fish will be coming up the surface gulping for air. And if you're not near water, you don't have a water source, or if the river dried up, the fish are going to die. So that's one of the things we always encourage the people to build a pond near a year-round source of water. It varied between tribe and tribe. In the villages that I worked, that was usually the case. The chief or the it was a chief who said, okay, you know, this area here, these 2 acres are your land to farm. And it was divided up that way. And so, you know, if you were given that part of land, that was your land, you could do with, you know, you could have your fish pond with no problem. Now, if you were to die or something, I'm not sure whether who would get that, if they would redivide it or, you know, be inherited by the son. No, they very seldom did that. We discouraged it because it was we were trying to figure out how much was being produced, being that it was a new project. We wanted to know what kind of production we were getting. And they didn't have scales to go weigh in each fish they got out of there. So we pretty much said, you know, if you could wait until harvest time, we told them that was the best, and they just went along with that with no problem. And if you were to try to change and say, okay, it's all right to go in there and fish in between, I bet you they'd say, no, we can't fish, you know, this is the way it is, there's no fish. Some people used to go and fish in the ponds, I mean, just sneak there and take some fish. We often heard about that. In fact, one guy harvests his pond and there was very few fish left in it. Most of them been fished out. Oh, that varies according to how often they work on it, how many people they have. I'd say, give you an average, I'd say maybe 3-4 months. Well, okay, there was a lot of people. When I first got there, everybody wanted to have fish. Everybody wanted a fish pond. And I spent most of my time, you know, going, looking at places and telling them, okay, this is what you got to do. Come back a week later, it's not done, not even attempted to be done. Oh, my grandfather died. Okay, come back next week. Nothing done. Oh, you know, somebody died in another village in the next village over, I had to go over, and funerals are big things there. There's a lot of things like that going on. So anyway, excuse, maybe 3 times I go, still nothing done. I think they thought when I was coming, I was going to dig the pond myself, I was going to plant the fish and cook their dinner and give it to them on a platter. Well, it took a while for me to figure out how to determine who was going to do the work and who wasn't. And so a lot of people would drop out once they realized how much work was involved. And I work with about 20 to 30 people in a year. And I would say those people I work with were extremely diligent. They were hard workers. I was very impressed with them. We didn't get any worms. We had never seen any worms on the fish at all. No, we didn't have them inspected by, you know, a pathologist or whatever, but we've often, you know, would cut into them and look ourselves but didn't see anything. Not under a microscope, that's with the eye. They vary according to how much work a person wants to put in and according to the terrain of the land. I would say, yeah. Okay, the smallest pond was about 10 meters by 10 meters, which is about, say, roughly about 30 feet by 30 feet, and larger ones went up to 2 to 3 acres. And that would only be in an area where they could just build a dam. Some places they built 4 dams, and that would usually be a small pond. Sometimes it was dug out. They just dig out the soil that was in there. Sometimes they built dams. So they range from very small up to, you know, a couple acres. Oh, I should backtrack this last slide. Well, all right, these are some of the fish that they've taken out. These are smaller ones. You can see that there are some really small fish in there, and yet it's protein, and the people eat it. So we were happy with that. Here's about the size they would be in 6 months. These are put in maybe about two inches long, and in 6 months they'll get up to about that size. And it's a good tasting fish. I was very happy with the project. I felt that I was doing some good there, and the people were very receptive, did good work. And by the time I was leaving after my 2 years, I could see some of the original people that I was working with had 2 or 3 ponds, and they in turn were helping their neighbors or friends to build ponds also. The goal of Peace Corps is to work yourself out of a job, and I could see that happening right there, because the technology or techniques are so simple that, you know, just by working with somebody for just advising somebody in a couple months, they can learn what's required to build a pond, what's a proper site, how to take care of the fish, and they can do it on their own. And so, in effect, it was snowballing. I seen more and more people doing it, and I was becoming less and less involved. I think for that reason, it's a very good development project. A lot of projects require outside assistance. For example, if you're going to start up a cattle project, you have to have vaccines, you have to have worm medicines, sprays or dips for parasites, and that's not available within the country. And other projects, you can say the same thing. Chickens need vaccine. They die every dry season if they don't get a certain type of vaccine. The good thing about fish is they don't need anything. Once they have the fish, they got the know-how, the project can continue. So it was a means of allowing the people to improve their lives through their diet and to help them towards self-sufficiency. With that, I'll answer any questions that anybody... usually they boiled or they fried it in palm oil. Most everything was cooked in palm oil, and palm oil it's a reddish color, and they would just fry it. Some people boiled it. If they weren't near the house, sometimes if they're down at the pond and they wanted to eat something when they were having a harvest, they would take some leaves and they'd fold those leaves over and close the fish in it and just put it right in a fire. And the leaves wouldn't burn, a certain type of leaf, and the fish would just be steamed in the leaves. They had, I don't know that much about their cooking. I mean, I've always eaten the food with them, but I didn't go in the kitchen and inspect what was being done. Sometimes they didn't gut them. Sometimes they didn't scale them. The head was always on. They liked the heads. They liked the gills. I remember one time sitting down eating with a couple of people, and we had fish, and the fish were about that big. And I looked at this guy next to me, and the fish was gone, and there wasn't even a bone on the table or anything. He just devoured the whole thing. I don't know how he did that. Uh-huh. Yeah, it is a good fish. You were probably eating bigger ones than we were. Oh, were they? Oh. Excuse me? No, it's currently, as far as I know, it's in Zaire, Central African Republic, Cameroon. They're starting one up in Senegal. Nigeria, they were talking about it. I don't know whether it, these are Peace Corps projects. They were talking about it in Nigeria. I don't know if that went through. Niger, they tried there. I think it was too dry. There wasn't enough water. This is all I can think of. There's probably some more.
Yes.
That can always happen. In the 2 years I was there, it didn't happen. Might have been fortunate. Sure, that can happen, but, you know, there's ways to combat that with fish. What you'd do then is just dry the pond out and just the sunlight coming down in there. Maybe it might take a couple months or something, but probably you get rid of whatever was in there, disease, kill everything off, and then you just start again. Now, I don't think it's something that would spread from all the places because most of these ponds are near springs or sources where the water's coming directly from the ground, so that if this fish pond got infected here, it's not going to affect the one over there. So if his gets infected, he can dry the pond 2 months later, get some fish from the guy next door and start over again. And this was one species of tilapia. There was many different types of tilapia. And there was we had two ponds that were experimental ponds that were run by Peace Corps volunteer. That's where we got the original stock of the fish from those ponds. And they tried different species, but found this was Tilapia nilotica. This is found to be the best one, grew the fastest. And we also, towards the end of the time I was there, some of the volunteers started working with clarius, which is similar to a catfish, to put in there in combination with the tilapia. They would then feed on some of the smaller ones. So it's more efficient way. It's called polyculture when we have more than one species, because if they're not feeding directly on the one fish, they can maybe be feeding on different types of food that first fish wouldn't feed on, so you're getting more out of it. They were just testing things like that. We didn't really encourage it because we weren't sure, and we didn't want to, you know, tell somebody to do something and find out it doesn't work. And I don't know the results of those tests. Okay. Originally, we got the fish from Cameroon, which is another country in Africa. Flew them into Zaire and put them in those experimental ponds that we had, let them reproduce, and then we had these fish reproducing very fast. I'd say maybe each time they lay eggs, they may lay up almost to 1 million eggs at a time. A mature fish would do, or thousands to 1 million, not all the time, but sometimes. So you're getting a lot of fish, a lot of reproduction. And so the farmer we start with, we take the fish from that experimental station and plant them in his pond. Once we had two or three people with fish, then if somebody else got a pond completed, we just get them from that pond there, and they would then begin to sell the fingerlings to different people. But once the area had a few ponds going with fish, that was it. They, you know, just went from place to place. And once one person did it, he didn't need any more. He just kept his own. We were stocking one per meter squared. Are you familiar with the metric system? Yeah, so 100 fish in a 100 square meter pond, 30 feet by 30 feet, 100 fish. Yeah, I should have mentioned it. I was there 1975 to 77. Yes, I have. I spoke with a couple of volunteers that came after me. They said the things were going okay, and the group of farmers that I was working with started to form a cooperative to help each other and buy supplies or equipment that they needed. After that, I've gotten a letter from a Baptist missionary who was nearby. He's an agriculturist, and
he often went through that area to help with other projects. And in his letter, he said that he visited a couple ponds that I worked with, because he said the people would always flag him down and say, come look at the pond, make sure I'm doing it right, take a look at the fish. And he said, things look real good. And then just recently, we got a letter from the ALC, and they included an article that they got out of the newspaper. I forget what paper it was. Anyway, it was an article about Zaire, and it was called The Success and Failure. And the failure was a power line that was being built by a U.S. construction company from the western part of Zaire, where there's a river. They built a dam, a hydroelectric plant. They were going to build a power line right across the whole country to the eastern extreme, to the mining region where most of the copper mines are. And nobody in between would be able to tap into the electricity. And what's happening, the people are tearing down the towers and taking the metal and making machetes or hoes out of it. And millions and millions and millions of dollars are being spent, and the thing's not completed yet. And the success story was the Peace Corps fishery project.